Of course, you would remember, I was a young television reporter, and we interviewed, and it may have been a Johns Hopkins, I'm not sure. Uh-huh. As I recall, it was outdoors. I think we did it outdoors. Mm. I could be wrong.
And, yeah.
I can't even remember what I asked you. Mm-hmm. But I was certainly aware of you then, because in the 50s, I had read Howl. Howl was the poem that I knew as a as a college student and got to know.
Where'd you go to school?
Became very impressed with that one. That was the one that...
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Lehigh University in Athens.
I've been there reading since.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Who did you work with? Dwayne Schneider, chairman of the English Department?
A long while back. Quite a while back. Maybe
they have a couple of...
Mid-70s or something like that.
They produced a couple of poets. Dave Smith one. Norman Stanley Plumley.
Yeah.
Plumley. And one, I don't know them. I know their reputation. I know one poet who went to our university is William Hayen. And he and I have become pretty good friends.
Uh-huh.
We've corresponded.
So you keep up your literary interests in the middle of Manhattan. That's pretty hard.
What's that?
You keep up your literary interests in the middle of Manhattan.
Well, there's no better place.
Yeah.
And on my little broadcast, which is called BookBeat, I have, I know that you are a fan of Robert Creeley. He's been on the
Absolutely.
Broadcast.
Yeah, he just had his collected poems out last year.
Well, that's why I talked to him. In conjunction with that, there was also his collected prose.
Yeah.
And so I had wanted to talk to Creeley for a long time. And
I think he's one of the maybe dozen great poets around. He gave me a great blurb for my book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I put one on his book, too. But we
You guys stick together a lot, don't you?
We've been friends and sort of collaborators since 1955, actually. We're going to meet again together. He came out to Naropa last year to teach. And then we'll meet again in Maine this summer for a Pound Festival and give lectures on Pound together.
He lives in Maine now.
But he lives actually in Utica, but he's got a house that he built in Maine for his new wife and kid.
He says he's going to commute.
Two kids.
He's going to commute.
Yeah.
For Maine.
In the summers he'll be up in Maine, and then in the winters he commutes from Utica to Buffalo, I think. He has to commute. He goes in a couple of times a week to teach.
I try to do poets on my broadcast where I can. And I haven't done a lot. I've done. I've talked to Richard Eberhardt, classic poet.
Yeah, another friend, actually.
Is he?
Yeah, he wrote the first article in the New York Times about my poetry ever, 1956. And I see him every couple of years.
He reminds me of Santa Claus.
Yeah, now.
And, James Dickey has been here a couple of times. I don't... He is...
sober?
Dickey described himself, he is a guerrilla poet.
Guerrilla academic.
Radical. He is not affiliated with any school. He's not a beat. He's not a New York poet, a Black Mountain poet.
Well, he belongs, like I do, to the American Academy of Arts and Letters, so we're both affiliated with the Academy. Actually, he's affiliated, if anything, with the Luce Network. It's been very favorable to him as an ex-fighter pilot.
I've also tried to talk to some of the younger poets. I don't know if you are familiar with their work. Patricia Hampel teaches at the University of Michigan, I believe. And Katha Pollitt.
Yeah, I know her.
She just 2 years ago won the National Book Critics mm-hmm. Circle Award poetry.
One poet I like younger is Anne Waldman. She's very good.
Who is that?
Anne Waldman.
I don't know her work.
She has a little book out from City Lights and another one from Stonehill Press, I guess it was. She teaches at Naropa with me.
Do you still maintain contact with Lawrence Ferlinghetti?
Sure, he's my publisher. He's signed the contract which guarded his rights to keep putting out my books so that he can sell the little pamphlets.
Through City Lights?
Yeah, and distributing them around England.
Well, I would love to talk to him at some point.
He comes to New York. Send him a card saying next time he comes to New York, let you know.
Yeah, I would like to. I still have a copy of Going Out of the Mind, which I've had since college.
Yeah.
And even then it was, I think, the 18th printing of it.
Yeah. Actually, I saw him just a month ago in San Francisco on my way back from China. We had breakfast.
In your collected poems, 1947, 1980, I started doing something that did not prove feasible.
Try to read it?
Well, what I tried to do was this, because I know in reading your introduction that you had laid it out so that it serves as a kind of autobiography.
Yeah. So this is a casual remark.
I tried to read it from page one.
Yeah.
And I found that was very hard. I found myself
skipping.
Yeah. And then I would go back and go forward and look for things that I remember reading many years ago and looking for them. And
they're all there.
Yeah.
They should be all there anyway. I don't think I left anything out. And I added some things that I'd never published before that were too racy for the day or involved people that were still living. And I put in little poems that were scattered in very tiny delegate magazines and broadsides. I also put in a lot of drawings and illustrations that had, of their time, been part of the poem when we put them out in posters. And I put in 50 pages of notes so that people could understand the references if they were trying to translate it into Chinese or Russian.
Those notes were extremely, extremely helpful.
I'm really proud of them. I worked for half a year on that.
Well, sometimes poetry is difficult, and the poet assumes that you know what he's talking about.
I think that's just lack of awareness of the space around him and the people that are reading. And I found that I didn't remember some of the details that I'd written about 30 years ago, so I was interested in checking back and making sure that I was correct in my references.
Well, even knowing Howell as I did so many years ago, I think I just mentally skipped over Malak.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think I was ever quite certain in my mind what or who Malak was.
I pronounce it Moloch myself.
Moloch, is it Moloch?
But that comes from the Bible. It's the god of... that's the second part of Howell, which I think is the best part rhythmically and in terms of visionary precision. And it's the old god of the Bible, one of the false gods worshipped by the Jews. He was a sort of a god of sacrifice and war to whom parents sacrificed their children. And I think there's a line in the Bible that says, "Thou shalt not pass thy seed through the fire to Moloch," which is in a way what the modern nations are doing with their children, sending them off to war.
In spite of what the writer in Time magazine said, I read it a week or so ago, where it rather dismissed Howell, and I think emphasized the Kaddish. I believe that like William Styron in Lie Down in Darkness, like Sloan Wilson in The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, all early first books, you are always indelibly going to be linked and known for Howell. I don't think you'll ever get away with it.
Well, I'm quite proud of the poem. I think it'll be around as a piece of rhythmical engineering like Poe's Raven or The Bells or Rachel Lindsay's Congo for a long, long, long time because it rings in people's ears and it also has a kind of visionary accuracy. See, for Time to dismiss it, they had to, as a period piece, they had to cut the line that they quoted and leave out the phrase, "monstrous bombs." The line was, "invincible madhouses, spectral nations, demonic industries, monstrous bombs." And to say that that poem is anachronistic, they had to get rid of the nuclear bomb in the line, the end of the verse. They actually had to amputate the verse to substantiate their opinionation. Rhythmically, though, I think part two and part three of Howell are kind of classic, expansive, unobstructed breath. And I think people will always appreciate that, like they appreciate Shelley's Ode to the West Wind or Adonais.
In Collected Poems, 1947 to 1980, you include, as you mentioned, almost everything from the early books. And in this book that was printed in 1961, you have, as you phrase it in here, quote, introduction, end quote, by William Carlos Williams.
Yes.
That wasn't really an introduction to the book, was it?
Yes. Actually, he helped me edit that book. That was the first book I put together. And he liked I sent him a few of the poems and he said, "These are great, these are it, do you have any more?" So I sent him about 85 pages of writings, more or less in his style, objectivist, imagist. He sifted through it and selected about 40 pages. He cut a few pages out of one or two poems and said, "Just keep the active language. Pages of inert writing are not as interesting as just one phrase of active language." Then he wrote it. Then he said he would try to get me a book published, which he wasn't able to do. But he did write an introduction in 1952, and then the book was published 10 years later.
Ah.
After Howell was published, after I got to be well known as poet, then it was Amiri Baraka, Leroy Jones, who was editing a series of modern poets like Frank O'Hara and Kerouac. for the 8th Street Bookshop down in Greenwich Village, and so they asked me if I had a manuscript, and I said, well, I've got this old manuscript with a Williams introduction, and I always liked it, and want to publish that. So they did. Now it's at the beginning of this collected poems from 47 to 84, and I think the first poem in the book, called In Society, is from that collection, Empty Mirror. That's the earliest poem published, 1947. A dream that I had of being a sort of a rejected outcast in a swishy cocktail party around Columbia University when I was a student there.
Didn't at one point, weren't you working in the gray flannel world as a researcher or merchandise man or something?
Any number of times. Actually, I used to do book reviews for one of the weekly magazines. I worked in marketing research up in the Empire State Building on the 52nd floor for a long time, and around Times Square doing market research. And then when I went to San Francisco in 1953, having failed to get anything published in New York and having carried parts of Burroughs' novel Junkie around to publishers and been seeing that rejected, and carrying On the Road around and seeing that rejected, I just took all the manuscripts out to San Francisco and settled there and got a market research job. But it lasted about a year.
You got a market research job in San Francisco as well?
Yeah, and market research is a sort of curious, marginal employment thing that you can always get a job, or you used to always be able to get a job if you knew the lingo and the terminology and some of the techniques.
What do you do?
Brainwash the public, basically.
You're still doing it.
Well, it's a cleaning of mind this time, rather than trying to manipulate it. The project I worked on in the Empire State Building was for toothpaste. They wanted to put out a $1 million ad campaign. I kind of makes your teeth sparkling, or I kind of makes your teeth furry. Glamorous. And I was doing word association tests, and the word glamour was associated with furs, and sparkling was associated with diamonds and pearls. And naturally, they didn't want to advertise that I kind of made your teeth furry. So I mean, it was sort of a simple thing that anybody could figure out who knew anything about language to begin with. But it's like what's going on in politics now, where you sort of hypnotize the public by analyzing their tendencies, or as the Buddhists would say, samskaras, their cravings, and their associations, and their mindset, and then you feed it back to them, and attract them to buy your product, whether it be a president or a toothpaste, by appealing to their mental tendencies, which you've checked with them to begin with to find out which direction they want to go, then you just sell it back to them.
Doesn't it take a certain amount of either courage or stupidity or something,
both,
to leave what may or may not be a secure job, but at least to have a regular paycheck for the life of a poet?
Well, actually, I realized that the work I was doing statistically and making graphs could be done by a machine. So I suggested to my bosses that they'd save a lot of money on me and my two secretaries and my executive salary if they'd switch it over to a computer, IBM at the time. And so they asked me to supervise it, and I did. And my reward was being dismissed and going on unemployment insurance in 1955, and then going out and writing Howl. It was a sort of a pleasant agreement between me and my employer, because I did want time off to do some real work.
What was it like in 1955 when you went out to San Francisco and you wrote Howl? And I imagine you made your base at City Lights Bookshop.
Well, no, I didn't know Ferlinghetti until I got together with a lot of other great poets that were there then. Gary Snyder, who's now an eminent world-class poet. Philip Whalen, who's now a Zen priest in training to be a Zen master. Michael McClure, who was one of the people that introduced the theme of ecology into poetry. Robert Creeley, who came over from Europe to visit the San Francisco poetry renaissance scene. Kenneth Rexroth was out there. Philip Lamonti, a great surrealist poet. Kerouac came out to the West Coast around that time and met Creeley and Snyder. And Philip Whalen came down, as I say, from the Northwest. Lou Welsh was corresponding from Chicago, and Burroughs was sending letters from Tangier. Robert Duncan was sort of the established great, and still is, great poet in San Francisco. So it was a nice meeting of Ferlinghetti was there, and Kenneth Patchen in City Lights, Kenneth Patchen visiting City Lights. But I didn't really connect with Ferlinghetti. I brought him this little Empty Mirror book, which he rejected. But then we all had a poetry reading, and he heard Howell and sent me a telegram saying, where's the text? I want to publish it. So then I began making City Lights my center, which sort of for economics and for friendship stayed like as a place to go and sleep on a cot when I visited San Francisco till the present time. I came back from China and stayed over with friends from City Lights about a month ago.
Tell me about it. I have that in my notes. You were in China, I understand, for a couple of months teaching there. What was that like?
Well, it was like revisiting the United States in the times when there was censorship in literature. Back in the 50s when I was in San Francisco, listeners may not remember that we did have legal censorship here on literature. You couldn't print D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. It was against the law to publish Howell even at one time, much less Burroughs' Naked Lunch, which only got liberated from the government on its back in 1962, much less Lord Rochester or Catullus. So in China, there's a definite control over literature, both erotic literature and political literature. Lately, the Chinese Writers Association, people whom we met, have tried to declare some independence from the ideological party line that's been imposed by Mao Zedong since 1942 on the communists there. But people, individually, one-on-one, are totally frank and surprisingly like-minded and candid in their criticism of the government and their disillusionment with the complete flip-flop reversals of interpretation of what communism, Marxism, socialism, Lenin is supposed to mean, even, because they've had so many different interpretations and violent convulsions in China, especially the Cultural Revolution, where every intellectual in China was sent off to shovel human manure in the Gobi Desert, practically, or in the provinces, or kicked to death or committed suicide, 20 million people at least. All the professors who'd had any contact with the West or studied in the West, or anybody who got a letter from the West, or anybody who was accused of being a, quote, bourgeois thinker, unquote. That's all, that nightmare is over there for them, and they're beginning to open up to, especially America, sort of almost heartbreaking how much they love the American hipness and openness.
Has any of your stuff been allowed in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, long passages from Howell, part one, have been translated and published officially in Shandong province literary magazines and circulated all over China. I was specifically invited there by the Chinese Writers Association to come and visit and consult with their writers.
You know, even with the knowledge of the sexual nature of some of yours?
Yeah, you know, like they just don't make a big deal out of that. They just say this is a great American poet. If we want to learn about America, we have to know his poetry. And in their official reading book, where it was 20th Century American Prose, Volume 2, published also in Shandong, which is used in all the colleges for people who are studying English, they have 50 pages of Kerouac's On the Road. So every Chinese kid who's going to be a UN representative or studying English for high-tech studies or go to a PhD at MIT, they all read Kerouac's On the Road now. And they appreciate the language and appreciate the spirit of it, which is really charming.
You have an interpreter?
Oh, yes, many interpreters in the different cities I visited and taught at. I went with our delegation, which included Gary Snyder, who wrote and translated Chinese.
Well, how do you teach? Or what do you teach? What form does it take when you're talking with people who are so alien in terms of their culture?
They're not that alien. They keep up with what's going on in the West. They ask, what have you and Gary Snyder been writing and thinking since we got cut off in 1963? We know Howell, we know Kaddish. What new work do you have? What books have you published? Who are the younger poets? What is the influence of William Carlos Williams now? Because they just translated Williams. Are you not in the tradition of Whitman? Things like that. They were most pleased with the vocalization of the poetry. They read it in a book. They heard Chinese English speakers pronounce it aloud, but they never heard any American, at least in the last generation, never heard an American get up and give a poetry reading like we do in America at St. Mark's Church or in coffee houses or universities. They don't know that influence of William Carlos Williams on making use of spoken language to really make sense in poetry. You know, the updating of the language from a dead literary language to the kind of language we use when we talk to ourselves when we're alone in bed at night, making no sound. There's a line of Charles Reznikoff, old imagist. So they were especially struck by the difference in tones used in reading, variable rhythms that Williams introduced and which all the younger poets have exploited and followed, and just the fact that the poetry made sense when spoken aloud. I thought that was great. And that it was vigorous. That it wasn't just sort of a murmur of somebody in his interior, but it was actually one person talking to himself really straight, or talking to others straight.
A moment ago you mentioned the censorship problems that this nation had, and it was hard to find a home for Howell.
Well, it is still, remember, you know, I couldn't read Howell on this program or on television. Could read it in the movies. Before, I couldn't print it in a book. I mean, Howell was attacked by censors and went through a court trial to be validated by the courts as not obscene. But you've got to realize we still do have censorship in America, in that the poems of mine that are considered classics by, say, middle-brow magazines like Time magazine are prohibited on radio or television because the language is the language that people actually use rather than the somewhat artificial language of the media, which is not the speech of common people.
Things are better, though, and also we have cable television, which is allowing a lot of the true language that we use into the home for the first time.
Yes, and movies have opened up in the censorship. Books have opened up. Cable has opened up somewhat. But most America takes its opinions and consciousness from TV, the major media, and that's still a closed area for the actual living speech of our citizens.
You mentioned that there were some new poems. There are some new poems in collected poems, 47 to 80. One is, I believe it's called, isn't it called New Loves?
Many Loves.
Many Loves.
After a title by Williams.
What's that?
After the title of a play by William Carlos Williams. Many Loves, meaning variant loves, or you could say deviant loves if you want. A description of the first night I spent with an old friend.
Neil Cassidy.
Lovemaking, Neil Cassidy. And I had not printed that because he was alive. He wouldn't have minded, but he had family. So I thought, well, I'll just keep that in my drawer, like the Russian or Chinese poets have texts written for their desk drawers, as they say. But since I put together the collected poems, and this was a major piece of writing from a period which is considered illustrious, that is Sunflower Sutra and Poem America and Howell, I thought, finally, if I'm going to have collected poems, I should put it in. I like it, but I couldn't read it over the air.
No, you couldn't read that over the air, and I would imagine that your description of your homosexual relationships in these poems in very graphic terms must have been, over the air, shocking. Did you read any of these on college campuses?
Oh, yes, I read all those. Every poem here I've read aloud in college campuses. There isn't any censorship there, or relatively little.
You could hear a pin drop.
No. People are used to that. I mean, they see really vile things through official pornography. They very rarely see any beautiful erotic work in circulation. And it's maybe a relief finally to hear some gay poetry that is not degraded or actually speaks from an older tradition, Greek or Whitmanic, about real love between men. That's a possibility. I mean, it's one of nature's possibilities, despite the moral majority, which wants to take control over nature, even.
Well, you have written explicitly of these homosexual relationships in your poetry. Mm-hmm. Not every poem, of course. Not conceivably be considered a homosexual writer, can you?
No, I consider myself like American, Buddhist, Jewish, gay, also bisexual, occasionally heterosexual, dope fiend or experimenter, intellectual, radical, conservative, libertarian. So it depends what I'm thinking about, what I consider myself, like anybody else. There's no permanent fixed identity. Like, all the constituents of being are transitory, including one's own ego, and that changes from year to year or moment to moment or decade to decade on a thought.
Which is why your poetry can win favor with a wide range of people with different philosophies. I, as a heterosexual, for example, associate extremely well with your material and have for many, many years.
It's very odd because, you know, even the some neoconservative people like people on Commentary or the National Review have given, National Review has given some of the best reviews of this book, these collected poems, as anybody. So there seems to be some common human ground that people are able to acknowledge without difficulty, which I'm very pleased at, because I'm just trying to record what I think from day to day, or epiphany to epiphany, as a human being, knowing my own vulnerability, knowing that my heart changes, as anybody else's heart changes over the decades, but trying to keep a record of those changes and trying to talk as with as much candor in public as I might use with my best friends.
Allen Ginsberg, your support of the drug culture in the 50s and 60s, is it still as extreme as it was?
Well, I was trying to get the government off our backs, as the neoconservatives claim to be trying to do, while they're increasing the surveillance capacities of domestic CIA. But it seemed to me that marijuana mythology fostered by the government confused the whole drug situation and left kids thinking that marijuana was habit-forming like heroin. I was interested in the laws, actually, changing the decriminalizing grass, and it seemed to me that sending junkies to doctors would diminish the number of street addicts and diminish the black market supply of junk by a combination of both narcotics agents who were corrupt and organized crime who were responsible for the importation. And I still think if we adopted the English system and were let doctors treat junkies and the government didn't interfere with medical practice, we'd have fewer junkies around, because it'd be less black market junk on the street. It's real simple. It's the old neoconservative line, get the government off our backs. Acid I liked. I thought that was useful, though now I would say much best combined with some kind of centering or meditation practice, so that people won't freak out when they see that they're not who they thought they were and the world is vaster than they imagined.
But to glamorize...
Cocaine I wouldn't like. I don't like particularly cocaine. It seems to me like... sort of a modern hype or a modern hyper-industrialized chill thrill.
But to glamorize the drug industry, I wonder if that does ultimately a disservice, because there are so many young people who have turned to drugs. In my family,
yes,
I have a family member who is still a young teenager who has had a terrible drug problem, because drugs in New York City are fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, not only has he overdosed in mm-hmm. the park, but he has gotten involved in thievery and violence, and I just wonder...
What drug are we talking about?
What's that?
What drug are we talking about?
Well,
this
particular family member has experimented with every drug, but primarily PCP.
That's the worst of the...
Well, PCP is a very inexpensive drug that can be smoked with a marijuana cigarette, and it's used mostly by urban kids because it's readily available. These kids can't afford cocaine.
Yeah.
And so they can use this drug, and it is. I have talked to having these problems myself. I've talked to experts, trying to figure out what I can do.
Well, I have problems too.
PCP is a scourge right now.
In my family, the major drug, which is actually sent me to the psychiatrist and sent my best friends to Bellevue, is alcohol. And myself, I'm at the very moment smoking some nicotine, which is causing me a headache. So there is a drug problem, sure. And I think if you separated out the drugs, decriminalized the relatively harmless ones, sent junkies to doctors, you would sort out the harmful from the relatively harmless and have a little more clarity in the scene, cut down on the corruption of the government agencies that are supposed to be supervising the drugs but are actually peddling them, as the Knapp Commission report discovered to the public way back in the early 70s, that the narcotics bureaus in New York, federal, state, and local were all involved with peddling and were in cahoots with Cosa Nostra. And I think you'd resolve the drug problem a lot more easily than the draconian blunderbuss approach that the over-swollen bureaucracy has taken over the last 20 years. It's a social problem, and I think it ought to be solved with common sense rather than hysteria and Jehovahic self-righteousness.
Well,
my family's got problems too. Your family's got, my brother's kids have had their problems, sure. I think a lot of it is caused by the simply confusion of public imagery.
Well, what you say makes sense. Nothing has worked so far that the government has tried. Yeah.
Drogue, actually, the word comes from the word drogue, German, which means dried herb. If we're talking about language there. We might have to ban chamomile tea if we're going to start banning, quote, drugs. You know, what is drug? What is my cigarette here? An addictive habit, certainly.
Yes, well, it's not equatable, though. It's
cancer.
It's addictive, and it causes problems within your body, but...
cancer, yes.
But drugs and alcohol tend to cause problems... Not only in one's body, but an impact on the people around them.
You ever see me when I'm trying to kick cigarettes? I get so irritable and begin screaming at people.
Well, I went through that a couple of times.
I think almost everybody has been through that with smokes, and that's like a lot of people know the horrors of that one.
Allen Ginsberg, your poem, Caddish, dealt with the insanity of your mother. I have a feeling that you are still preoccupied with the many... emotional problems that you're in.
Very much so, as anybody would be all their life. My mother died in Pilgrim State Hospital out on Long Island, which is a mental hospital. She had had many series of shock treatment and a lobotomy. And I wrote a long elegy for her a few years after she died. And then had a dream about a year ago and woke up about 5 in the morning and wrote it out in a poem called White Shroud, in which I met my mother, still living as a shopping bag lady in the West Bronx, with surviving and a little irritated that everybody had ignored her all these years. I wondered, why hadn't I gone to visit my mother? Not realizing the dream that she was already in her grave. And I had a long conversation with her about, well, now where could we live? I got enough money, we could afford an apartment. After 25 years, we could call up anything in California. I can afford a telephone. Then in China, I had another dream called Black Shroud, which was in which I'd cut my mother's head off and was trying to, you know, wondering how I would have to pay for this, and then confessed to my editor. So apparently it's still a matter of conscious rumination.
I have a feeling those poems will appear in print at some point, and we won't be hearing the end of The Voice of Allen Ginsberg.
No, the next book is called White Shroud, and that dream poem, Vision, is a title poem. It was printed already in the New York Times last fall. A big, huge page, sort of an epilogue to Kaddish.
Buddhism, what has that done for you?
Well, it made me more aware of my own irritability and cranky temperament, and... made me a little more patient with myself, and therefore with other people, with my own failures and vulnerability. Made me more conscious of the procession of thought in my mind, and cultivated some sense of extending my awareness out into the world. Provided some kind of political ground, in the sense that I realized that the mass hysteria and anguish and aggression of American hypermilitarization and Russian hypermilitarization can only be resolved by individuals checking out their own awareness and checking out their own aggression, and then moving in some social direction which will be a little bit more sensible, rather than bankrupting both countries just to raise the specter of destroying each other. Because I don't think anything's going to happen, really. I don't think there's going to be a nuclear disaster. I think people ultimately are too sane for that, which means that all these giant weapons and $250 billion military budgets are all for show. And it seems stupid, foolish, to be bankrupting the entire world just to put on a show of being number one and standing taller than anybody else. It's sort of self-defeating.
Are you still on the FBI's security list?
No, I think at Watergate I got taken off the security list. It's a funny story because I was put on by J. Edgar Hoover on a dangerous security list in 65, just at the same time that I was being kicked out of Cuba for criticizing Castro for his persecution of gays, and kicked out of Prague later that year for writing in my notebook that all the communist lies about capitalism are true and all the capitalist lies are about communism are true. I had been elected King of May, and they disapproved of an American beatnik, degenerate capitalist or whatever, being a popular literary hero, And so I was booted out of Czechoslovakia, from Prague, by plane to London, where I ran into Dylan and the Beatles. But simultaneously, J. Edgar Hoover was putting me on a dangerous security list because I'd had the nerve to legally challenge the government's refusal of a visa to visit Castro. In those days, you know, the Bill of Rights meant something. Nowadays, I think the administration has reformulated their case about visiting Cuba. You can't visit Cuba anymore now, like you could after 65. The gimmick they've got is that you can't spend money there. So they've evaded the Bill of Rights by putting a Treasury Department administrative regulation that prohibits people from going around and checking out themselves, or maybe going down there and sabotaging the Cuban thought control. It's sort of self-defeating, that kind of bureaucracy. It's a point I did really want to make. The neoconservative Reaganite view is get the government off our backs, and instead they're just putting the government deeper and deeper into our backs and on top of our backs. It's more bureaucracy, a hypertrophic bureaucracy in the military, extension of secret police into people's lives, extension of police into the schools now, I hear, curtailing a Bill of Rights, freedom to travel abroad, which was sort of basic to the Constitution, threatening press occasionally, as Agnew did, and still continues somewhat. So in a sense, the government is heavier on our backs than ever before, and the national debt will be on the backs of succeeding generations. So there seems to be some kind of totally schizophrenic mindset on the part of the government and maybe on the part of the public, although I think it's true that the majority of the public did not vote in this election for Reagan.
Well, there's no doubt that there's a great deal of political orientation in your poetry. You must be an inveterate reader of current events.
No, I stopped reading the Times a couple of weeks ago. It was just too much to keep up with. But I'm political or social in the sense of if the secret police put me on their dangerous security list and I'm only a poet, then what is that? What the hell is that? That's not the America I learned about when I went to grammar school and read about the Bill of Rights and about democracy. I got put on the Narcotics Bureau list for getting up on television in 1960 and opining with Norman Mailer and John Crosby and Ashley Montague, all respectable gentlemen, that there might be a possibility of changing the laws on marijuana. And from then on, for the next 3 years, anytime anybody said anything in that direction, it got put in my file. And that led to 1965 being put on the dangerous security list and strip searched every time I came in from a trip to Europe. I got kicked out of Prague, kicked out of Havana, came back through to New York City and was strip searched because I was on the dangerous security list here. I got the impression finally that the police bureaucracies on both sides of the Iron Curtain were sort of needed each other, just sort of mirror images, fed on each other. They wouldn't have jobs otherwise, neither would the military.
Allen Ginsberg, we're just about out of time. You still live a good portion of the year in New York City, don't you?
Yeah, I have an apartment in the Lower East Side, which is relatively inexpensive. And in summers, I go and teach at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, with William Burroughs and Ann Waldman and Gregory Corso and Amiri Baraka and sometimes Gary Snyder or Robert Creeley or Michael McClure, the folks we were talking about. The old community of poets is like a good, healthy community, and most of them are grand survivors, producing better and more intensively than they did way back in the 50s.
Didn't I read somewhere you have an unusual way of admitting people into your apartment?
Well, I live in an old slum building, and there's no bell, so people either yell up from the street or call on a phone, and I toss a key down, and a clean sock. It's efficient.
Hey, Alan, let me up.
Yeah, I can hear. I'm usually working at my desk by the window.
My little broadcast doesn't have very much time. It's mostly a news broadcast, but perhaps if you have a portion of a poem that you'd like to read, I might be able to use a portion of it as maybe an open and a close.
A real short poem. Verses written for student anti-draft registration rally 1980. The warrior is afraid. The warrior has a big trembling heart. The warrior sees bright explosions over Utah. A giant bomber moves over Cheyenne Mountain at Colorado Springs. The warrior laughs at its shadow. His thought flows out with his breath and dissolves in afternoon light. The warrior never goes to war. War runs away from the warrior's mouth. War falls apart in the true warrior's mind. The conquered go to war, drafted into shadow armies, navied on shadow oceans, flying in shadow firefight. Only helpless draftees fight, afraid. Big, meaty white boys trying not to die. The warrior knows his own sad and tender heart, which is not the heart of most newspapers, which is not the heart of most radio television. This kind of sadness doesn't sell petrochemicals. This kind of sadness never goes to war, never spends $100 billion on MX missile systems, never fights shadows in Utah, never hides inside a hollow mountain near Colorado Springs with North American Aerospace Defense Command, waiting orders that he press the secret button to blow up the great cities of Earth.
Still at it.
Well, that's a relatively political poem. Most of my poems actually are a little bit more tender and love poems. Actually,
I would like to ask you if you would not mind reading the opening lines to Howl for me.
Well,
you
yeah.
I have that memorized by now.
No, I don't have it all memorized. I got the first line memorized, but I'd have to find it, I'm afraid. Wherever it is, if you give me a moment.
Well, I know.
No, I'd rather read Peace of Moloch. That's the middle section of Howl.
Well, I'll read a little of both. Read
okay.
The opening line and
Moloch's more interesting. The opening lines of Howl are, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, who poverty in tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs, illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake Light tragedy among the scholars of war. Because of the opening lines. The part
I used to read aloud at 3 o'clock in the morning after many, many beers. And
well, it's like a little... It's like
it sounds wonderful.
Well,
I heard my voice in my own ear reading that.
It's like a saxophone jazz chorus. I think it was imitating a myth, or perhaps a reality, of the great black saxophonist Lester Young playing 69 consecutive choruses of Lester Leaps In or Lady Be Good. The poem which I spoke of is rhythmically more interesting, or the part of the poem Howl, was the second section talking about, well, now what happened to all these people? Why do they crack up? What sphinx of cement and aluminum bashed open their skulls and ate up their brains in imagination? Moloch, solitude, filth, ugliness, ash cans and unobtainable dollars. Children screaming under the stairways. Boys sobbing in armies. Old men weeping in the parks. Moloch, Moloch, nightmare of Moloch. Moloch the loveless, mental Moloch. Moloch, the heavy judger of men. Moloch, Moloch, robot apartments, invisible suburbs, skeleton treasuries, blind capitals, demonic industries, spectral nations, invincible madhouses, monstrous bombs. Well, that's a little section of it. It's got the rhythms of...
You've done that before.
No, actually, I read it in the way that it was boldlerized, so it could be read on American television and not be quite as powerfully accurate as the actual text. Censorship here in America is failed, folks, dearies.
Yes, I'm afraid that broadcasters utilize a certain amount of restraint.
They call that in Russia self-censorship.
Self-censorship.
Yeah.
Well, it was wonderful after a quarter of a century bumping into you again and in this very calculated way.
Well, thanks for your hospitality.
I'm delighted that I had the small vehicle that is able to permit your voice on it. And
I'm glad I still got a voice.
Well,
for the Collected Poems 1947-1980 of the speaker, Allen Ginsberg.
This will certainly be mentioned, and you know, many people sell real estate to make money, but it's obviously that you're and broker the real estate of the tracks of our minds. And
yes,
I thank you very much.
That's a real space.
There's a lot of it to hold.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming in and talking.
Thanks for having me here.